that Kubrick, it seemed to have more of a curiosity about women and maybe the layers of female relationships with men and kind of the power that women have in the male-female dynamic.
Right. Well, certainly Kubrick, certainly Eyes Wide Shut is the obvious example, he's been analysed in this way as the thing, the commentary and the subtext of his films and so on. But that doesn't actually interest me very much, because I don't think that's what most people who study Kubrick movies in this intense way, I don't think they're particularly interested in that stuff. There are a few academics, and they're necessary to maintain this idea that Kubrick was a great filmmaker who was working out all these profound questions. My sense is that Kubrick actually wasn't that interested in those subjects. That's my feeling. Whereas Hitchcock, I felt, is kind of life and death. I'm like, he couldn't even sexually perform.
Mm.
He was so obsessed with the unobtainable woman and his mother, Psycho, and so on. Like that's what interests me there is that difference. Or right now, anyway, what I was exploring is that difference. Sure, I mean, if you look at any man, probably a Western man who's making movies, let's say, or is successful in the world, you probably will find similar Freudian issues. I wouldn't argue against that. But I don't know how much that reveals, because they're probably fairly universal, those kind of issues. At least, yeah.
I just think of that moment. This was in the Room 237 film that we just watched as kind of a primer for this interview. I was watching part of it, and one of the scenes that kept getting brought up was the actual Room 237 and what that represented in the film. And when Jack Nicholson goes into that room and he sees the woman in the bathtub, and what that whole scene, kind of pulling the layers back of that scene, of what that represented. So I think that was the thing that kind of brought this Freudian element of the unattainable woman, or the woman being corroded, or somehow luring him in, and then being on some level representing like this demonic force or this death energy
in the woman. Well, I mean, that I do somewhat get into, not that scene, but The Shining, I do get into a slightly Freudian interpretation of The Shining, and that's probably because it's the only Kubrick film to me that does reveal something about him. Like, you could say in Eyes Wide Shut, obviously there were lots of ideas and themes and stuff around man, woman, this, that, and the other, but you can't separate the medium from the message. Like, Eyes Wide Shut, to me, that there's nothing recognisably human in that movie, really. The
mm-hmm.
characters is just so strangely stilted.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's, to me, that's proof he's doing something else, and he's managed to keep himself out of it, really. Whereas The Shining, I think he couldn't keep himself out of that movie. That's just the only Kubrick movie of late years that I actually like and find that has some richness. And so I do interpret that movie in the Kubrickon. It's almost like, I don't know what Chris thinks, but it's almost like a departure from the main thesis, because I examine the Shining, yeah, for its psychological content, and what I see it as a kind of blueprint, and I even tie together all the Room 237 interpretations and show how they're all related to a betrayal by the father, or a father who doesn't give a son the blessing. So there, and it's in different ways. Like there are five different interpretations in Room 237, and they all seem incompatible, but they all symbolically relate to this, to a son who is betrayed, abandoned by the father in some way, and the consequence of that is that the mother, the son is imprisoned by the mother, is trapped inside the mother's psyche. So I see the Overlook as the mother's psyche, is representing the mother's psyche, and of course the whole movie is about a father who betrays his son, or I mean tries to kill his son, more than a betrayal. And so yeah, anyway, that's actually that is entirely consistent with the Kubrickian thesis, this whole idea of the matrix, which has to do with the male psyche that is trapped inside the female psyche because it never managed to separate in childhood. And that's my name is Big Mother, that's my next book. That's kind of that's kind of the unified theory, I think, of all of my work, mapping hell, you know, what went wrong. To me, that's what went wrong. The male of the species somehow never made it out, fully out of the mother's influence. But, I mean, that's a very big subject. I'm just kind of throwing it in there because you kind of led us there, I think. And it's, as I say, it is in the book, The Kubrickian, and it certainly is consistent. I mean, it only gets fully developed in Big Mother, but it's consistent with the drive to create artificial intelligence if you connect artificial intelligence to this larger thing that we're living in now of creating a matrix, as in a whole social structure. Mm-hmm. We talk about the nanny state, the technocratic nanny state, an entire panopticon of artificial intelligence controlled and directed technocratic society. That is Big Mother. That's the recreation of the mother's body as an artificial construct in which no one ever gets to grow up.
Fascinating.
And for some reason, I'm randomly thinking of the, I don't know if you ever saw Ready Player One, or you know about the part of Ready Player One where they go into the movie, they actually go into The Shining. And I should have rewatched that before this interview, but yeah, there's a part of the movie. I don't know if you read the book or you saw the movie, but they actually go into the bathroom scene and interact with that, and it's crazy. I don't remember all the details about it, but that's sort of shows some AI leanings into that because it was included in this totally fabricated universe that Ready Player One takes place in.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Shows it. What?
I didn't know that. That's a good point. I would have included that in the book had I known it.
It's worth checking out just at least that scene. But were there any of those narratives or any of those takes on The Shining from Room 237 that you leaned into a little more that resonated with you more than the others? Or did any of them?
Well, they all resonated the way that they were presented. I very much enjoyed that. And that movie did help me to revisit The Shining, give me a new interest in revisiting it. And there's definitely something. And that was a big clue. Like, Kubrick was trying to create movies that would be Rorschach tests, that would reflect the viewer's psyche back at him, which... You could say that sounds perfectly benign and that's creative and all the rest of it, but I add these other elements and say that no, it was done more intentionally and more in a more manipulative way than simply giving the viewer an experience, but it's kind of harvesting. Because if you think what the viewer puts into a movie, let's say this interpretation, where does that go? Well, it went literally into Room 237, so that's a kind of good literalization of this, that the viewer himself or herself is creating these stories via their interpretation that Kubrick didn't put in there, but he created the movie in such a way it would draw them out of the viewer. That's what I took about as attention harvesting, getting information from the viewer that will feed AI. Anyway, that was a digression because I was answering your question specifically. I mean, I suppose the most... I don't know, fruitful answer would be that it is all of them together. Like, I might have a personal preference, I think, for John Fell Ryan's, because he didn't really do much interpreting. He just did this weird thing of playing them backwards and forwards at the same time and came up with all this stuff, and he wasn't particularly analysing, so I kind of enjoyed the flavour of that most. Obviously the moon landing is the most titillating. And probably that's the one with the most legs. I mean, that's a real meme, if you like, not a meme as in an image, but it's it went viral. I don't exactly find it credible. I find it credible that it was intended. Like, of all the interpretations in Room 237, I could see that that one was intentionally put into mm-hmm. The Shining, that people would interpret it. Not because it's true, because I don't think it is true, or not wholly true anyway, maybe 50% or something, but because it would be generating obsession. Yeah.
So what 50% do you think is true? I'm just curious. I'm very fascinated by that whole narrative myself.
I think that the moon landing footage is fake,
mm-hmm.
is true. As I've said on Twitter, it couldn't possibly have been Kubrick because it's too obviously fake. Right. Surely he would have done a much better job, and he would have been appalled to have ever been blamed for that footage, right? Or to have been given the credit. But that's me, you know. I don't want to insult anyone who does believe it's real, because that might sound like what I'm doing, but I certainly can't look at it without thinking, how did anyone ever believe that now? Whereas if I look at 2001, I think, well, it's better than the effects today.
True. Yeah, maybe he was just doing it half-hearted. Maybe his heart wasn't into the moon landing,
or it was meant to be. I could say a cognitive dissonance creator, which is what I'd say about the Kubrickon, actually. So it'd be consistent in a different way. But you were meant to know at some level it was fake. But because, as we've seen in the last few years, Fauci and all that. You can have all the evidence of the senses that shows you something's fake. If there's a voice with enough authority telling you it's real, people will go with the voice saying it's real. And that creates a split, or it deepens the split that's already there. So it could be consistent with that. I should make it look fake, Stanley. And he's like, no, I'm sorry, Stanley, you've just got to do it really badly. Well, then why hire me, would be the question.
But, you know, he had other, as you stated in the book, he had other ties to those sorts of circles, too. And then later on, or maybe even at that time, AI itself, what do you know about the Steven Spielberg, Stanley Kubrick AI situation? I don't know much about that movie, but I know Steven Spielberg kind of obviously was the one who actually made a movie.
Took it over, yeah. I don't actually know, and I don't get into it in the book, even though it's an mm-hmm. obvious, it's not a smoking gun, but it's an obvious, supports my thesis, and totally confirms that Kubrick was very interested in AI, if that ever needed confirming. Why he did it, you know, Kubrick and Spielberg working together, to me that's a relevant data point too that gets overlooked. In terms of if Kubrick was really, I mean, I suppose Spielberg did do Schindler's List. It's not like Spielberg's a total, I can't think of a word for it, but you know, he's not totally disreputable. He has a reputation, but still, to me, they seem odd bedfellows, is all the only point I'm trying to make there. Yeah,
very much so.
Yeah, I mean, it was Stanley Kubrick must have known. If he let Steven Spielberg take over his AI thing, it would be a stinker. Not that he wouldn't have made a stinker, look at Eyes Wide Shut, but at least it was a Kubrick kind of stinker, which, as I write about, they're very intentionally bad in these very strange ways. He's trying to create anomalous experiences, whereas Spielberg just does stuff badly often, which mm-hmm. is what happened with AI. I didn't do a lot of looking into the AI and the backstory as it happened.
I just wanted to circle back to The Shining and the Overlook being perhaps a representative of the mother or the woman. Perhaps we could take it out one more level and say, instead of the Overlook, it's the earth that represents the mother or the woman. And the dichotomy is that Kubrick is choosing artificial intelligence or his desire for that kind of futuristic perspective over the earth. And he sees the earth as being the eviscerator or the controller. And so maybe breaking away from that is his desire to break away from that maternal thing. The earth is this obsession with artificial intelligence and the future.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I just don't go that deep into Kubrick's own psychology. Clearly, The Overlook doesn't represent woman or woman's psyche or woman's body in any healthy way. It's a demonic matrix, but that's very much the point. Like a child, a male child who is trapped in the mother's psyche, it's because the mother herself is trapped. She's not functioning, and she's clinging to the child for some kind of salvation or some kind of emotional support. But sure, that would extend, you know, that kind of pathological or dysfunctional or unhealthy attachment to the mother would extend to a rejection of the body and of the earth, and it goes very deep. That's the subject of Prisoner Infinity, actually, and it brings us back to the moon as well, because the moon is an image of the mother as well, symbolically, although a dead one. I don't think, you know, the moon is dead, so again, it's not a very positive image. But the bid to get to the moon or conquer space, starting with the moon, is also a bid to get away from the earth. And so there's a weird symmetry in that, because at one level it's like the male psyche is trying to bond with the mother by getting to the moon, but it's just an image, because actually what he's doing is he's trying to get away from physicality, he's trying to get away from his body by entering into this dream realm, which brings us back to the Matrix again, and movies in general, right? You know, what are movies, and why does somebody make movies, and why do we want to watch movies? I think that Kubrick, to some degree, why I was interested, I think, in writing about this subject is that by aspiring to a kind of, to be the ultimate filmmaker, he maybe got closer to showing the pathology behind movie watching, movie making, and the technology as well. Like, because movies, they are a technology, unlike writing or song or much of the older arts, they weren't dependent on technology. I mean, you could say a flute is technology if you want it, so it began. You could even say a pen is technology, but you don't, strictly speaking, need a pen to write a poem. You certainly don't need anything to sing a song. Movies, on the other hand, were probably the first art form that was just completely and utterly dependent on technology. Actually, I would think.
Need lots of props and technology to make a movie, for sure.
And the faking as well. Like, it much more than any other art form previously, it's to do with faking reality.
What role, and perhaps you may have answered this question in so many ways before, but what role do you think that Kubrick, or maybe the better question would be, Kubrick's movies played in the superculture?
Well, can you, because, like, I'm not sure what you mean by the superculture. I mean, I know you got it from me, but I'm not sure if I remember what I mean. So, yeah, how do you mean?
The superculture meaning the larger context that what we know, or what the average person knows as culture, that nestles inside of a larger culture that actually engineers and orchestrates what we call culture from sort of behind the scenes, in the sense of,
You
understand?
So you mean, you mean, like, politically, or in terms of actual organized crime and intelligence operations, do you mean it in that sense, then?
Yeah, specific things like sense. That, what is behind Hollywood, and, you know, a layer beyond what we're used to looking at, or what the average person is just still looking into.
I haven't really answered this particular question before. People often ask about, you know, what was Kubrick involved in, you know, what were his ties and connections, and I get very bored very quickly trying to answer those questions, because it's always facts and figures and numbers and dates, but names. But this, what you're asking, is a little more general, and it's occurring to me that although they're not mutually exclusive, it seems as though Kubrick and his movies were, again, what I said earlier, I'm getting hoarse for some reason, a higher level of social engineering than average, because it seems as though he was embedded, I mean, he was in bed with NASA, for example, for 2001, and that's, I mean, we can't really comment, we don't know in terms of the hierarchical structures, who's high, you know, CIA or NASA or the mafia, who knows, right? They're all entangled. But certainly NASA's closer to the legitimate institution that we think of as benign, we think of it as a hub of science and discovery and so on. In fact, I think NASA is really embedded in organized crime and child trafficking and these things, but don't quote me because I've got very little evidence for that. Some of it's firsthand, though, so I tend to believe it more because it's direct experience of just being too close to those kinds of institutions and locations where weird, bad stuff is happening. But anyway, that's very much a digression. But so to me, it is all one superculture, and you know, any powerful institution such as NASA is going to be involved in organized crime, probably the worst kinds of organized crime. But just talking, you know, imagining that they are a bit separate, or you know, we tend to perceive them as separate, it seemed that Kubrick was working very much with, if not for, that aspect of superculture that is the superculture which is less obviously shady and more, I guess, therefore, because it's more respectable. Like CIA, well, they've become kind of respectable again in the last few years because we really have been, I don't know what the word is, but things have got weird recently. But I was going to say the CIA intelligence organizations, they didn't really have a very good reputation over the last few decades. And so the idea that organized crime and stuff is involved in that, it shouldn't be that much of a stretch. But the world that Kubrick was moving in, although post-Jeffrey Epstein, it shouldn't be a stretch either, is very much sort of MIT science, NASA. That's what it seems like to me. That's my impression. And that, so he was, I think he was, of all the filmmakers I can think of, bar none, he seems to be the closest to rubbing elbows with a kind of visible elite. Like Minsky, for example, Marvin Minsky, he was hanging out with this guy for 2001. Arthur C. Clarke, well, okay, he's a novelist, but still, he's kind of, you can see his elite connections, they're quite visible. And even the way that Kubrick is viewed, he is the film director's film director. Like,
yes.
He kind of embodies the whole idea of elitism, even though he's often presented as this family guy and this very ordinary guy. Yeah, he lived in a mansion, but what would you do if you had money? You know, there's all these apologies for him. But he still exuded a kind of elitism. So, yeah, I mean, that's my sense is that he's more obviously useful to the superculture, and because his influence and his operations were more closely aligned with the visible edifices of power like NASA and science and whatnot, as opposed to a filmmaker who's just embedding certain messages in there and you know, creating some sort of insidious propaganda. My impression is that Kubrick was very much a key player in a long-term game plan involving the creation of this big mother thing, so artificial intelligence algorithm run society. That, no, you know, without doubt, is you know, a major tool, if not the major tool, for social control in the 21st century. You know? Computer technology, cybernetics. And Kubrick's the only filmmaker I know who is visibly involved in that aspect.
It's interesting, Hunter and I were recently, how this is kind of a recent example of how Kubrick is still in the pop cultural lexicon. Hunter and I were recently watching this cartoon on Netflix called Inside Job, which is basically very conspiracy, like every conspiracy that you can possibly think of is somehow drawn, like looped into the plot arcs of this cartoon, which is episodic. And in one scene, they are in a cloning lab, and there are lots of different celebrities and religious icons. I don't remember who all was in there, but there's several of the cloning pods that had Stanley Kubrick in there. There's like seven Stanley Kubricks. So it's like, he's still around. He's still in the peripherals. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's iconic, and it's ironic then that in a certain way he is identifiably this kind of elitist, social engineer-y kind of filmmaker, while at the same time part of his, central to his reputation in 2023, which has been really boosted by the post Room 237 crowd, as in the YouTube kind of exegesis, is that he was some sort of whistleblower, some sort of, you know, yes, he was an insider, but no, he wasn't really working for them, he was working against them, and his movies will set you free kind of idea.
Yeah.
That just seems really ironic to me.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting that he, as you said, was an insider, but he was sort of, if we're to believe all of these different ideas and theories, sort of sending us messages, very blanketed messages through his works, that he, one of them being that he participated in filming the moon landing, and that he obviously was not pleased by that, because he's, if we are to believe these different narratives, has been trying to tell all of us that he did have something to do with that, and maybe he was doing it against his will, and maybe there was some kind of deal made, and maybe that's how he got to the position that he was in. Who knows? Because he's, you know, his movies, I'm more fascinated by the fascination that people have with Kubrick's movies than I am his movies. I don't think that they're that great, to be honest. So it's interesting that he's heralded as such a masterpiece filmmaker, and I just don't think his movies are that good. I mean, they're decent, they're well made, but they're not, you know, it's subjective, I know, but
maybe, I mean, at some point subjective has to become objective. It's just, you don't want to be the guy who's saying I know that point, right? Because then, you know, you're probably going to get into trouble. But yeah, obviously, you know, I agree, and hopefully hearing the Kubrickon, it doesn't sound like you needed help, because you didn't probably have the, as a film writer for 20 years, for me it was more than just, well, his movies aren't that great, I don't know what everyone sees. It was like, what's going on with you people? Why can't you see? Particularly Eyes Wide Shut. It did bother me. It really did bother me. And so, I mean, this is kind of central to why, before we started officially doing the conversation, why I said, please don't ask me about Kubrick. It's just an ironic position to be in, because yeah, I don't think his movies are that interesting either, but, and certainly not that good, but something is, and yeah, somehow people got obsessed with them and he became raised up, and there is something to look at there. Obviously that's what we're talking about, or why we're talking, but it's still a kind, I still feel a bit like Jack Torrance in The Overlook, like I've always been the caretaker, why am I still talking about Kubrick? Can we you know, get to something that's more interesting, right, in itself, as opposed to what Chris just said. Like, it's interesting that people are so interested in this, and there is a reason that's worth exploring, but still, at the end of the day, the result surely has to be, let's not talk about Stanley.
Yes. Should we move on to the Bible?
Well, I would love to, but I think it might disorientate your listeners too much.
I'm totally open to that, but is there any other thing that you want to address, or anything that you see on this question list?
I'm just curious about the influence that being in his films had on people, because it seems like some of the people in his films went mad, not necessarily right after they were in his films, but I just wonder what the tone was like on these sets and how you know, this idea of creating a film is creating this alternate universe or this alternate timeline. I find it fascinating to be an actor and be embedded in these realities and how that would influence your life, you know, in subsequent films that you've made or subsequent sets you were on. And that was, I guess that was the part of Room 237 that I really enjoyed, was kind of seeing these behind the scenes moments where you're actually seeing Kubrick interacting with some of the actors or people just kind of milling around on the set. Do you feel any connection whatsoever to the Indigenous people's story or that aspect? Because I do feel like there is a level of resonance there for me, that there's something about the land and being in that land. And again, this battle, not only against Native people, but against the earth to kind of settle these parts of the earth that maybe are vortexes or power spots. Did you feel any connection to that?
Do you mean in Room 237, that interpretation?
Yes.
No, although, I mean, it's not that I don't in a general sense, but not while watching Room 237, although that one at least did correspond with a plot device in the film. I know that it did say it was built on an Indian burial ground, so, which wasn't in the novel. I'm wondering if there's a connection between, because it's like you started with one interest, which was the effect on the actors, and then you moved to the Indigenous. Are those two subjects connected? I missed how.
I feel they are, because I do feel like there's a, not necessarily a curse of the people, that the people who have, you know, been on this land and maybe you know, had some negative influence by drawing attention there. I don't know. I just felt like there was perhaps some overlap with Stanley and his desire to be in this specific place and maybe to add these elements of Indigenous people and kind of the bastardization of that whole subject matter from the white man's perspective. So I do feel like there is some commingling there. I guess maybe I'm not articulating it.
I'm also curious, because I like the devil in the details, to me, to really get to grips with something. Who do you think went mad? You said that people involved in Kubrick movies went mad afterwards. Who are you thinking of?
Clearly, Shelley Duvall has had some mental health issues and has seemed to kind of go off of the rails. And obviously not right after making that film, but there could be some residual elements there. And I think Jack Nicholson, you know, for all intents and purposes, he has a problematic personal history. And again, you know, you may not be able to make a direct link between working with Kubrick and his behavior, because he probably had problematic behavior before he made that film. But I think people who make have these very intense characters, I think there is some residual effect from that.
Absolutely, for sure. Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, I mean, they were on Eyes Wide Shut for 400 days, I think. It's the longest film shoot in history. And there is a theory about that, which I didn't develop in the Kubrickon, which had to do with, because it coincided, him casting those two coincided with Vivian Kubrick joining, if we're going to be neutral about it, the Church of Scientology. And I can't say causally, you know, which if there was a causal factor relation, which caused which, i.e. did Scientology get their hooks into his daughter because he was getting his mitts on Tom Cruise, or was it the other way around? I think it was more likely the first way. But either way, the idea that Kubrick was, there was some sort of struggle between Scientology and Kubrick with his daughter as a hostage on the one side and Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman as hostages on the other side. Now, that's obviously that would require a lot of filling in the blanks there. You could write a novel about it, but to me it's very tantalizing, and it points to this larger idea of what Kubrick, particularly any filmmaker, but what was Kubrick doing besides making a movie when he took captive, in this framework, these actors, whoever they were, for a given film, and basically would not release them for months and months. Like Matthew Modine, he tried to stop Matthew Modine leaving the set of Full Metal Jacket after 9 months or something. They were still shooting, but I mean, it was just going to be one afternoon in a 1 year shoot or whatever, to be present at the birth of his son. Right, that was the level of Kubrick's control that he tried to maintain, and that suggests the kind of impact that he was consciously willing to have on his actors in the name of Project Stanley, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Another example, it's a different example, but of this a general same principle, that Nicole Kidman, for the sex scene in quotes, I mean just the flash cut of the fantasy of her having sex with the naval officer, which is what L. Ron Hubbard was, the naval officers, there's a Scientology link there, that it was 4 days filming and nobody was allowed in, and certainly Tom Cruise wasn't allowed in while his wife was feigning having sex with a stranger. You can imagine the psychological effect that would have had on the husband, maybe not Tom Cruise, because who knows, but if there was a genuine love bond there, it would be a negative effect, and that it was somewhat intentional on the part of Kubrick's part, because that's what directors do. They want to create the right psychological conditions for the performance, which in this case was feeling jealous and insecure and threatened. Right, so there's an overlap there between what a director does to maintain enough control to create the work that he wants to create, and the kind of control that's actually sadistic, borderline psychotic, that involves imprisoning people in your fantasy world and exercising complete dominion over their world, you know, inner, outer certainly, but eventually even inner. To me, yeah, those are all very interesting or very necessary questions. Like, what, how sane or healthy is it to make a movie under those conditions? Obviously it's the spectrum, because it's going to be to some degree some sort of artificial conditions, otherwise you wouldn't make a movie. But Kubrick took it to the extreme. And the other thing that's obvious to mention is the 80 takes or something. Like Jack Nicholson, I think at certain points was on his knees, like begging Kubrick to tell him what he wanted, because he couldn't do it another time. And this is Jack, this is Jack. This is Jack Nicholson, right? He's not going to bend over for anyone except Stanley Kubrick, maybe.
Well, and I've heard that there was a sex therapist on set of Eyes Wide Shut, because they had to, and I heard this from someone that works in the business, I don't know that they necessarily worked on the film, but that Tom Cruise... Well, Nicole Kidman's father was the head of Scientology in Australia, and the rumor that was being bandied about in Hollywood when I was working there was that they had signed a deal for 10 years, and that Nicole and Tom would be married for 10 years, and nearly 10 years to the date, they got a divorce, but that she was basically signing on to be with him to help her career, obviously, because she was very big in Australia, but hadn't really broken through the United States film market, and that they were not sexual partners. And so this person, this sex therapist, actually had to teach them how to look intimate on the set, because they had no intimate relationship. So from a psychological perspective, separating them for those 4 days could be an intention to try to stir up those emotions that did not exist.
Mm-hmm. Sure, because even a man who's not, might even be homosexual, but who's not really that, passionate about his wife, could still feel very ego threatened by her having sex with another man. So even that, and that's just as central to the story of Eyes Wide Shut, is the insecurity of the male psyche. Yeah.
Yeah, this little cut scenes with her, with the guy from the armed services, are so unconvincing. Like, they're like out of an 80s music video. They're really horrible. This really awkward sort of slow-mo, just not erotic in any way, shape, or form.
Well, and that brings me to another point about the many outtakes, I mean, the many takes, which is one of the reasons Jack Nicholson ended up on his knees was he knew he couldn't, he certainly couldn't do it any better than he'd done it, but he didn't even know how to do it any different. But it finally, either penny dropped or Kubrick just told him that Kubrick actually wasn't looking for a better performance, or certainly not a more realistic performance. Probably more the official version would be he was just looking for something unexpected. But I think even in the official version, because it certainly, he said, Nicholson quoted Kubrick saying that he didn't want realistic, realistic was boring. So he was intentionally looking for something that was kind of artificial or kind of unnatural, which we can certainly see the apotheosis of that in Eyes Wide Shut. But I would say, and certainly in Eyes Wide Shut, it does, and some degree in The Shining too, I think it more or less pulls it off, the unnatural, it eventually segues into just bad, and just because it's unconvincing, it's stilted, it's kind of cringeworthy. And so there is an argument, and I make it in the Kubrick column, that Stan Kubrick was actually trying to get bad performances out of his actors, and the only way to do it was just to beat them down and wear them down until they had nothing left, and then that's the take, right? I mean, I'm simplifying, but... And that's a kind of psychological torture, really.
Well, it's breaking someone. That's what the military does, is breaking your own sense of yourself and breaking your psyche. And then the idea is that then you become part of a collective. So perhaps that's what his intention was, is that he's breaking your ego, not necessarily to get to the best version of you, but just to get into this cohesion of being part of this collective.
Yeah.
So the clunkiness or the badness is the intention. Because you're not performing anymore.
Yeah, and also hollowing out. If you hollow someone out as MK Ultra, you can then colonize them. And I think there's an argument to be made that Kubrick, and it's very obvious in 2001, that he didn't really want actors. He just wanted these hollow vessels that he could manipulate around as puppets. And that he intentionally and deliberately tried to, as I said about his movies, to hollow them out, to make them empty. I think that was part of his methodology.
Very odd. And I keep thinking of Wes Anderson keeps coming up for some reason. I think because the way that we're describing these Kubrick movies and how they actually end up on the screen, to me, is a lot of what I see Wes Anderson's movies ending up as. The interactions are very clinical. There's not a whole lot of heart there. There's the intimation of heart. There's like people that want to be heartfelt, but it never is quite convincing. And there's almost an obsessive and very obvious and blatant attention to detail and meticulousness. Only I think his movies are a little more entertaining, actually a lot more entertaining than Stanley Kubrick's.
I just had a idea. Perhaps the idea is to offer this clinical perspective of the human so that you can then embed yourself in that role.
Sure.
So it makes room. Like, so there's half of the character, and then there's room for the viewer to stand in that space as well.
Yeah, so it's interactive media. That's back to this point. It's trying to make the media more interactive, but in a way that isn't conscious on the part of the viewer. and therefore I'd say is potentially much more destructive. I mean, not to say that interactive media is always destructive or always harmful, but certainly I think mostly what we've seen, the interactive media that's become popular, is designed by the military as a way to basically create good soldiers. I mean, that's the simple version. There are obviously more subtle aspects that video games and interactive media are designed cynically or maliciously to colonize consciousness of the user, but at least you're aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what we're talking about here, a viewer doesn't necessarily know that. I mean, conscious level, they want a fully rounded character in a story that's compelling. They don't want to have to fill in the missing parts themselves, because that's just a bad movie. But if it's done well enough, as we're talking about here with Kubrick and Wes Anderson, you don't notice, partly because your eyes are so taken up with all the detail and admire, so beautifully done, and the colors, and this guy's a genius. But in the meantime, another part of you is aware, but you're not paying attention to it, that there's something missing here, and so you want to fill in that missing thing doubly now, not just so you have a good experience at the movie, but also so you can maintain the idea that this is a great movie by a genius. Couldn't possibly be two-dimensional or hollow characters, because he's a genius, right? So you're, again, back to this thing, and this is a hard thing to talk about. There's something very subtle, and I mean, we could talk about sorcery if we want, and I'm sure Carlos Castaneda would have had a theory about this, but maybe I shouldn't have mentioned him particularly in this company, but I got a weird feeling. But that if you imbue these things with your own energy, that's what you're doing. I mean, I didn't make that complete sense. If you invest in them in such a way that you complete them, as Hunter was saying, you are putting your energy into them, and that's an objective phenomena. That isn't just a metaphor, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow you are, and it's a two-way thing. By projecting your consciousness and your feelings and into that character to make it whole, you're actually taking them into you as well. You're letting that character possess you. So that symbiosis. And of course, movies absolutely do that. If you identify, as I did with Travis Bickle, you're kind of Taxi Driver, you're kind of getting possessed by Travis Bickle. Even to this day, I've got a green army coat like Travis, and I feel cool if I wear it. I've also got a poncho like Clint has in Fistful of Dollars, you know. I'm still not free. But at least it's conscious,
and
I can laugh about it. But the ordinary movies do that. We get possessed by the characters, and we like the way it feels. But this is, I think, this is a deeper, subtler level that we're talking about here. That happens with, or we're talking about these wooden or these weirdly stilted characters in a Wes Anderson or a Kubrick movie. And I've stopped watching Hollywood movies almost entirely, but I certainly stopped watching Wes Anderson movies, because time and time again I just had this experience of, well, what the hell was that? It looked really good and it was clever, and there was I chuckled a couple of times, but he's just showing off, and he's not really showing off anything really interesting. Like, it's, I mean, there probably is something more sinister going on, because it's not enough just to say that they're self-indulgent. I think my niece, who used to be a fan, she just saw one. I can't remember what she said, but it was almost like Wes Anderson is... It was a kind of a more nuanced way of saying he really has got lost up his own asshole now, right? He's creating replicas of his own previous movies, but maybe as Chris is suggesting, that there's something deeper going on, and I think he still gets good reviews, doesn't he? Probably.
I don't know, actually. I don't read movie reviews, but I would imagine he does, because obviously his budgets aren't getting any smaller. So.
And the actors who want to be in his movies, he gets more and more big names.
The last one had Tom Hanks in it.
But it could be like a cultural autism. So the idea now is that we are all kind of disassociated and disconnected. And so the characters are being presented as being these kind of outliers or disassociated and disconnected characters. So it's reinforcing that idea that if you're cool, that's how you are.
Yeah.
Like kind of this unfeeling, like a husk
of
a human.
I was thinking that too, but that's a really essential thing about the characters that are created for media, especially interactive media, is that who particularly younger people, but anyway, viewers are being coerced into identifying with. Obviously, that's a really important thing to control. Is that, you know, what kind of human beings are they trying to manufacture? And I think that's really central to it, that there is an intention to create more and more dissociated, less and less physically or psychologically present, more and more kind of machine-like human beings. Not to say that autists are actually like that, because I identify as autistic myself, but there's this kind of simulation of it. And back to 2001, I mean, that was sort of part of the point, I think, of Kubrick's thing, or at least it was. And Clockwork Orange, which came after in a similar way, I mean, there's two examples of the same thing, but they're different examples. That the human beings in 2001 were so robotic that actually Hal felt more like a character. Now that gives me a bit chills, really, because I think that was intentional on Kubrick's part. And you don't care about those characters. And you're not supposed to, but you do care when Hal dies. And then A Clockwork Orange, what you have is, they're not so much machine-like, they're more animalistic, actually, most of the characters in Clockwork Orange, but they're so kind of debased by the Kubrick and by the film that Alex, the psychopath, is by far the most likable character. And we're left with, at the end, with, they've turned him into a Clockwork Orange, that's bad, he gets cured, oh, he's back to being a psychopath, that's good. And that creates this cognitive dissonance around a false dichotomy. Either human beings need to be programmed and turned into machines, or they need to be allowed to be themselves, which is psychopathic, you know, rapists and murderers, essentially. And he did have a very misanthropic view of human beings. And of course, hopefully all those points I made have to do with this converging agenda to get people to comply to being automatized, you know, dehumanized.
I like the point that you make in the book too, that if a movie takes multiple viewings, requires multiple viewings to appreciate it, that there's something awry there. There's something to be suspicious about.
Certainly in the case of Kubrick, I mean, there are movies that I didn't get the first time, but at least I got it the second time. I mean, if it takes several times, and Kubrick case takes several years, and I think that maybe the key factor, it also has required a small intelligentsian consensus, a growing consensus of intelligentsia saying, reevaluate this, you need to reevaluate this. So that there's a coercion in there as well. You might, you know, how many people would have tried Eyes Wide Shut again if they didn't, A, have what's got Kubrick's name on it, so really I better look again, B, oh, these people are saying they looked again and actually they didn't see what was there, the wonder that was there the first time or the second time or the third time, but the fourth and the fifth time they did start to see that it's about this and it's about that. All of those things that conspire to essentially get you to spend another 2 hours staring at corporate media, I think you've got to smell a rat.
Do you think that Eyes Wide Shut, speaking of that, further mythologizes things like sort of this pedophilia or sexual deviance that maybe these institutions or groups partake in behind the scenes? Or do you think it serves some QAnon-esque way of exposing it somehow.
They're synonymous, actually.
Sure.
I mean, QAnon is conspiratainment to me, yeah. Even though a lot of it's true. I mean, that's the tragedy is too strong a word, but it's a travesty. Because I was thinking as you started asking that, because I was thinking, you remember when Alex Jones in the early days and John Ronson, I think it was, it went to Bohemian Grove and supposedly mm-hmm. snuck that footage.
Yeah.
I mean, did you believe that? I didn't believe it. There's no way I believed that for a second, that they, if this was really what it was supposed to be, that they managed to sneak in with video cameras. Come
exactly.
on.
Yeah.
Come on. That's fiction. That's entertainment. But what kind? Very strange and subtle, because I don't think it was just staged. I think probably the only way to square the circle is that Bohemian Grove itself is kind of staged. As in,
mm-hmm.
yeah, they do get together and do that, but that's for the public who are getting wised up. We'll put on a show for those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Pizzagate was a bit of this. There was probably some LARPing, and we'll poke fun at them with our Instagram, and we'll trigger all of these pedophile hunters and these 4chaners and all the rest of it, and create a PSYOP. Obviously, it was a massive PSYOP, Pizzagate, by just giving them a simulation of the truth, which isn't a movie, it's an action. You know? They could still go to Bohemian Grove and have fun, but they don't have to have high security. There aren't any children there. There's nothing really seriously illegal going on.
Yeah.
They have to have fun, so I don't know. Maybe one has to speculate a lot, and I'm being glib when I say have fun. I mean they would want to get up to something pretty nasty, because Clint Eastwood was a member of that, apparently. But anyway, so that Bohemian Grove, Eyes Wide Shut. Yeah, it's what is that? That's how. You turn the attempt to try and discover the truth about what the elite are getting up to, which is a very powerful urge, it's actually self-preservation at a deep level, into a video game, into a form of entertainment. And of course people would rather it be entertainment, but that it's only really entertainment, or it's the best entertainment, is you don't know it's entertainment. You think it's really happening. You really are exposing the pedophile elite. But meanwhile, like Karl Rove said, they've created another reality. They've created another Bohemian Grove or a Davos, and that's where they're doing the stuff. They've left this Potemkin village of Davos as a souvenir, but to attract the tourists, the conspiratainment tourists, to think that they're doing some real deep digging, and
like Area 51, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, who knows there, or whether that's it's either nothing to do with aliens, or there's something completely different going on. I mean, I can't even speculate, but Area 51 is low hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm.
You or I would probably feel silly to talk seriously about Area 51, which is part of the hoodwinking as well, because it could actually be, it's like if you taint it enough, that also works, right? Because then
absolutely.
The serious minded people don't go there, and they don't explore it, and it doesn't matter how many QAnon people rant on about this, because they're just ranting to their own choir. They're validating another, validating the mainstream version, like with the John Podesta and Pizzagate. I think it was Washington Post, all they had to do is print an article with the headline, John Podesta drinks blood at secret parties with Marina, they presented it straight, and the ha 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 was just, between the lines, like the fact they were presenting it straight was enough for the readers of the Washington Post to laugh and know it was a joke. They didn't have to signal that it was a joke, because the language of the second matrix of conspiratainment has been formatted in such a way that it is laughable to the demographic that might actually seriously get uncomfortable if they started to think about these things, and to the demographic that is already inured to it, while at the same time with pitchforks out trying to chase the pedophile elite, they don't even realize that it's laughable.
Mm-hmm.
the language, I mean. Obviously, the subject isn't laughable, but the language that's been formatted for it is like, I mean, I've had this challenge with all my books. Like, I have to keep saying, this is not that. This is not, you might think this is the same as what Alex Jones is saying, but it's not.
Yeah, I don't see them in the same remote field of research by any means.
No, but I mean, you're one of my few readers. Like, you're a discerning reader, therefore you're one of the few that I have. Like, I only really get discerning readers, which is never very many.
What was I going to say? Oh, did the are you familiar with the movie The Sound of Freedom?
Yes, I watched the trailer recently. I submitted to the trailer just in case.
Did it make it to Spain? Is it a phenomenon over there at all? I know it's got splattered everywhere here.
No, I haven't. Okay. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily know. I could check with my Spanish acquaintance. Yeah, but I don't think so. We're on the internet, obviously. It's global. Yeah, why did you see it?
I didn't see it, no. I've just been seeing, you know, plenty of people pro, like, finally the stuff is getting out to the general public. Make sure, you know, people are buying tickets for viewers that haven't even come to the theater yet, so people can go and see it for free. And then all this other stuff comes out that the guy that is the subject of the movie, that the movie is a dramatization of his life and his campaign to expose all of this stuff, is now encouraging people to get, you know, your children aren't safe, they should all get microchipped, aha, that's the reason this movie is existing, is to get, you know, kids into the Matrix too. So I was just wondering if, you know, there was a Spanish take on any of that, or whether it got any...
Well, the other aspect of that you didn't mention was who funded the film, which is Carlos Slim.
Oh, yeah, I don't know much about
who is a cohort of the Clintons.
Okay.
And that the movie was actually made 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And the question is, why is it being released now of all?
And what's an answer that's been offered for that one?
That it's a distraction from the whole Hunter Biden debacle and all the things that are happening.
I guess that would be the answer. Yeah, well, to me the trailer was enough in terms of, well, whatever, you know, I mean, I would just assume the kind of things you just said, because it's getting such widespread coverage, it can't be good, it must be in somebody's interest. But even independently of that, I can see from the trailer, again, the medium is the message. Anything that presents a reality in such a way that it debases it doesn't do a service. That's my beef with Alex Jones and even David Icke. It doesn't matter if 100% of what they said on one particular occasion was true. It's all slimed. I'm sorry, David and Alex. And it's nothing personal, but you slimed it by saying it. There's just something off about the delivery.
So is there a graceful way to navigate that territory, though, while still getting something meaningful and pertinent across without it being slimed, without it getting slimed in the translation?
Well, I think we're aspiring not to slime anyone today, aren't we? So
absolutely.
So you have to be more specific, I think, because I'm certainly not saying talking about these things is a bad idea. Obviously, I am saying you can do it in the wrong way and that the wrong people can do it. Mm. I think the main point that I made was that, you know, the medium is the message, cliche, but who's talking about it and then why? Because they're going to be inseparable. The who leads to the why. It's my thing with David Icke. He just seems too much a man on a mission, and not in a good way. Like, he's really, he just seems to have some sort of drive that I don't find very wholesome. But we're talking here about, I mean, I'm not even aspiring to sell any books, to be honest. I don't think these interviews have made hardly any difference to book sales. I don't expect them to. I'm really doing this to have a conversation really. And of course, I want people to listen, and maybe I will hear from one or two of those people if it reaches enough, and that will be a meaningful connection or not. They might ask for a one-to-one, or you know, sometimes I do group online groups. There are possible benefits in terms of establishing lasting and meaningful connections, but to me, they never have, and they never will expand to some large audience base. So that to me is to do with the sliminess. Is sadly, it's kind of inseparable, as I say, from somebody who thinks they're on a mission to, even if it's a mission to save children from sex trafficking, which is so much baked into that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a reality that most people can't even think about. They can't feel their way into, and they already want to stop it. You can't stop something if you haven't allowed yourself to feel it and at least start to understand it and live with it. I mean, it's a cliche, but if you want to change something, first accept it. Actually, I'm going to go against the serenity prayer, you know. It's not just let me accept the things I can't change, but accept the things maybe I can change as well. Accept them first, because then you know that the desire to change doesn't come from an inability to accept. I think we need to accept. This is back to Job. I mean, I mentioned Job at the beginning, that I'm exploring that, the book of Job. It's very much not the message, because it's not a book that has a message, but it's very central to the meaning of the story of Job, is that at a certain point, if you're going to orientate yourself towards God, towards life, towards the soul, you have to be willing to accept absolutely everything that happens, because it's all coming from God, and we don't understand God's plan. Sorry, that's a cliche, but when you start talking about God, you always end up, you know, mission creep. You always end up saying absurdities, but the main point was this acceptance. And that was drifting from this other point about, oh, child trafficking. Yeah, like most probably people listening to this would say, how dare he say that? It's unacceptable. How dare he suggest that we should accept child trafficking? But you have to accept it. It's happening. Like saying I won't accept it doesn't change it. And exactly. Actually, nobody out there who's listening to this is going to be able to change it. And that movie's not going to change it. Right, it's too vast. It goes back to, you know, Babylon and Baal. It goes back thousands of years.
Yeah.
So, Christ, I mean, understand it. At least start. Anyway, sorry. I was kind of keep bouncing away from finishing even a sentence. But people who are trying to change things. That they don't understand,
mm-hmm.
They're not going to get anywhere. So that's the thing that's really missing. Like, if I hear somebody talking about these realities and I don't feel a kind of gravitas that they really know what they're talking about, they know how serious it is, and not Alex Jones, we've got to stop these psychopaths killing our children. Like, that's not gravitas. That's just showmanship.
Yeah, and pure emotion, too.
Yeah, it's not an emotion. Yeah, gravitas has nothing to do with having strong emotions about it. There might be very deep feelings, or there would be.
Yeah.
There are very deep feelings about it. But they would need to correspond with the reality that we're talking about, which is what it's like to be one of those children. And we have that, some of us, in our own body memory. Well, we all have it in our ancestral memory. Back to mm-hmm. The Shining, isn't it, and that whole thing. So if we're not tuning into that and allowing ourselves to be with that, we're not going to change anything. Like, it does have to start in our own nervous systems.
Exactly.
Well, I think the hypocrisy for me is someone, you know, maybe complaining about child, like, not even just child sex trafficking, but let's say more like child slavery, like people working in mines and they're tweeting about it on their iPhone or driving their Tesla, driving their Tesla and complaining about, you know, child slavery, when what they're doing is actually reinforcing those things because they're using a car that relies on the battery that got the resources from these these mines.
Yeah.
So I think that's the disconnect.
Yeah, well, it's in a house of cards. So I mean, that's another aspect that if people allow themselves to see how deep it goes and how far it extends, they would go into crisis. They go into emotional and psychological crisis because it's so fucking horrible. But pardon my French. But they'd also go into just practical crisis because I can't possibly drive my Tesla, can't use my cell phone with a clear conscience, can't send my kids to any institution ever again, right? They would actually have to start planning a way out of hell while they're in this deep psychological crisis. So yeah, of course, people are not doing that. So then it's entertainment. I say that if, okay, we are talking about, I'm not saying that this is just entertainment, maybe it is. I mean, we did start with me talking about in Spain and that, living in Spain, and that, to me, that's important, that I do have, I can at least say, I am making some steps, and that is a direct consequence of having looked long and hard enough at the state of our world to really accept that, yes, I can accept it as something that's, I can't personally change, but no, I don't accept having to be complicit with it just because I want to be comfortable. No, I mean,
And that's one of the sort of the conclusions and quotes that we came to, I think, when we were talking, rounding out the conversation about 16 maps of hell, is that, you know, changing yourself is changing the world. And some people want to start with the world and not even really even consider the self. But I don't think that there's any other way. You have to go through the conduit of self first. And if you're changing yourself, you in turn are then changing the world, especially some issue like child trafficking. You're not going to be able to just, you and a group of friends, go out and bust a child trafficking ring and stop it in a whole country. I mean, that's never going to happen. You can just not participate in that yourself is a perfect start. Encourage those around you not to participate in that. And you just kind of have to be, you kind of have to be all right with just that. It's not like you're going to go out and stamp a head linchpin in some huge organization like that. You just have to, you know, have the awareness in yourself and live as much of an ethical and wholesome life as you can, and hope that spreads out.
Okay, so here's my question. So does that mean never watching another Marvel movie again?
That doesn't sound like a big sacrifice. Come on.
Because or
it depends
not,
on how you interact with Marvel movies.
Right, but I'm saying if you are paying a ticket to go to a Hollywood film, you are reinforcing and re-entrenching and bolstering up child trafficking and all of these tentacles of the same beast.
That's where you download them illegally.
it is a long hard road out of hell. I dropped the point that I am not really watching Hollywood movies anymore. I haven't sworn off them. It's just not that interesting anymore, and that's to me a much healthier way to extract myself from a culturally toxic system, is not to use my will and say it's bad, I've got to stop doing it, because well, you know, in the scope of things, it's not that bad. Like, one doesn't want to overemphasize, you know, the sin of complicity. It's awareness. Like, the more aware I am of what's embedded in these things, the less appealing they are. And
sure.
So there is a natural reorientation away from those things and towards more wholesome things. I don't know, like, I'm not sure that the world itself will ever change, I'll say that as a point. I think there's something like a shared field that we're in as human beings that pre-exists the world, that exists prior to the world, and the world comes out of that, and that the whole satanic ritual superculture is about destroying or disrupting that natural human energy field, which is aligned with nature and therefore with God or the divine, disrupting it and creating an anti-life field or an anti-human energy field or an entropic field, and that's very much what's going on. There doesn't seem to be any natural justice, right, to compensate for the social injustice, I mean, for the injustice of the world, and God doesn't appear to be stepping in anytime soon. This is in the book of Job. Job is saying to God, why the hell don't you do anything about these evil people? Why am I suffering so much? Lost all my children, and now I'm covered in boils, and I've lost everything. He's reduced to nothing. And he was a good man, Job, and he knew it. And he's like, why the hell are you making all this happen to me while these evil bastards continue to thrive? And he didn't get an answer from God. But the implicit answer that Job has to reach is, well, God is working on a different time scale in some unfathomable way, and currently letting evil prevail is part of a larger thing that's going on, and we don't have the overview to say. But the other point is to make is that God kind of implies, well, he says outright, he says to Job, if you want to stop these evildoers, go ahead, be my guest. Why don't you do something about it? As in, he's the one who's complaining about it. Well, help yourself, you know, be my guest. Like, God himself is working on a different scale of things, where evil here and evil there is part of a much larger tapestry. And you could say there's cruelty and destruction in nature. So at what point are we going to say to God, oh, I don't think actually we should let lions eat gazelles because I think it's mean, right? God's point to Job, I think, implicit, is you're the one who wants to control the natural order so that you like it better, right? So that the evil get punished and so on. But that's not the way I do things. So if you want to check, you know, you go ahead. Of course, Job's like, what the hell am I going to do? And Job is man enough to accept that God does know more than him. He's still innocent. He says, you know, God, you're still a bit of a bastard because I really didn't deserve this. But, and I hope, you know, someday I'll understand. And I think he does understand in the end. But he does acknowledge that God knows more than he does. And what occurred to me is that that's very profound, actually, what the insights in that book, because actually the social engineers are closer to the kind of God that Job wants before the penny drops. They're trying to eliminate injustice and illness and death and discomfort. They're trying to make a logically ordered world. Right? Whereas God's saying, yes, it's illogical that you have to suffer when you didn't do anything wrong, and that the evil prevail even though I'm a good God, supposedly, etc. From your point of view, you're right, it's illogical. But from my point of view, I'm not confined by logic. I'm working, you know, with other things besides logic.
Right.
So it's not God or the gods, if we want to be more pantheistic. They're not. Their ways can't be fathomed by logic. It's human beings that try and make the nature submit to logic, and that's, we know what a great idea that turned out to be, right? It's not something to aspire to. So then actually that's the thing that created hell. So that seems to be, that's back to this thing, that the challenge is to, it's not even change the self to change the world, because then we're still in that loop of thinking that the world needs changing. It's just look at ourselves in a way that allows ourselves to experience existence and our relationship to it in new ways, and what opens up new possibilities, really, and so on and so forth. Like, there can't really be a, like, this desire to eliminate suffering, that's a bad idea. And yet, you would hardly think that that was a sign of a bad person, that they were trying to reduce suffering in the world. But again, if you look at the social engineers, a big part of their rationale, and even I think their intention, has been to reduce suffering. They're increasing it enormously and into whole new areas of suffering that transcend the physical, even, you know, that sort of spiritual suffering. But they do seem to be driven by a fear of suffering, a fear of pain, a fear of death, etc. So that's just, I think that's helpful to look at that and be aware of it, that that's clearly not the path to wholeness or happiness or harmony, which leaves the alternative, which is you accept suffering as part of a larger order or just part of existence, and something that you just learn to live with, and you learn to work with it. Sorry, I'm getting very philosophical now, but
no. That's I think that makes sense in a way that's more dealing with the present. Whereas if you are trying to change something, that means that you have a vision of something and how it should be, and you're trying to match your reality or the reality to that, when that might not be the right thing for everybody. That might not be the right thing for the person that you think that you're helping by doing this, that, or the other. Whereas just navigating the present and trying to make that whatever transaction or interaction or whatever way you're engaging with whatever is happening right at that moment, the best that you possibly can, or leave it as open as you possibly can for the best or the positive to come in. That makes more sense, I believe.
It's a lot easier to relax as well if you're not
for sure
trying to secure good outcomes in the distant or even the near future, and just what's actually happening right now, and how do I best respond to it. Now, obviously, we all do, but I mean, even me trying to be as natural, land-made a man as I can, I do have projects, you know, I build things. So obviously that is an eye towards the future. So it's obviously, I'm not prescribing some philosophy of total laissez-faire, and that would be absurd. But there's a level, we've lost touch with the level of, it's back to what I said at the beginning, I think, about having dominion over the earth. That used to be a positive thing, because there is a law of matter, and in order to get free of it, let's say, we have to obey it. There's a paradox in there. In order to transcend the law of matter, maybe I shouldn't say transcend, but certainly in order to work with it in the best possible way and be at harmony with it, we have to obey it, because there are just laws of matter. But it's a give and take relationship. If I obey the law of matter with wood and nails and stuff, I dominate matter. I'm dominating it by obeying it. I guess because it's insentient, really. It's not. It doesn't have a will, and I do. So it will conform with my will, but only if I obey its nature. So that, to me, that's a... it's a haiku or a fortune cookie or something. There's just something in that's baked into our relationship with existence, is that we can have dominion over matter, and this is symbolically or theologically, this is Satan. Like, to serve God is to some extent to obey the law of matter, and so there is a submission even to Satan, as Job experiences, because Satan is a minion of God. Like, God gives Satan permission to torture Job. But if we get aligned fully with our nature, then we're a servant of God. So that means we have dominion over matter. We have dominion over Satan. And so there's a symmetry there. But anyway, that's all very highfalutin. At a purely experiential level, growing crops and taking husbanding animals and building structures, that's pretty much as far back as you can go, or as you need to go, to what's just natural and inherent about how to live on the earth. It's many hundreds of years. It took many hundreds of years for human beings to migrate or devolve from that to Mark Zuckerberg's Metaverse 2.0. So it looks like it's a really bad idea to try and control environments, and as I say, it is, because if it's all about avoiding suffering and trying to be immortal. But if it's just about building a shelter and having animals and crops, right, obviously, you know, go to town, and you have God's blessing on that, because that's human beings being true to their natures and thriving through, you know, the sweat of hard work. I know it's very traditional, but
yeah, after our chat today, I'm going to go dominate some matter in our backyard. I'm constructing a chicken run for the 7 chickens that we got a few months ago.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Why 7? Do you need that many eggs?
We had 8, but one passed. It's our first time. We don't know what we're getting into. 7 may be too much. I don't know. If we always have neighbors we can give eggs to if we have too many, but so far we're keeping up with it.
We have 2. And
oh, okay.
A, it's enough eggs, more than enough, we give to my sister. And B, hopefully you won't have this problem because you'll train them right. But our chickens have not been trained because I left it to my wife, and she's too maternal, and they're noisy as hell, I tell you.
Yeah, ours aren't. I would argue that nails and wood are sentient, and they are just vibrating at a different level.
Sure.
Than the human is.
But would you accept? Sorry, you can carry on. But just briefly, would you accept that they don't have a will?
I don't know. I've nailed a piece of wood before that was not working with my will.
Yeah, well, that's the law. That's the law of matter. You were trying to get around the law of matter.
And I also think that there are moments where we are placed in front of situations where we are supposed to intervene. That's why we were put in that moment, was that we are supposed to exercise our will, or we are supposed to do something. But in the same breath, I can use an example of someone that I know who was not necessarily impeccable with their energy and wanted to make a film about a homeless person, for example, and gave this man a lot of money. And in his mind, by giving him this money, he thought he was helping him. And the man ended up overdosing, taking that money, and was clearly not in the right state of mind to have $20,000. And he OD'd in a bathroom in Venice, California. So I think that's where the ego gets involved and says, oh, well, I know what's best for you, and let me give you something where you, your own karma or your own energy may not have the capacity to handle whatever that is, that social engineering, that intervention came in, and it worked against this person and not for them, because there was a natural order of what was happening in this person's life, and something came in and tried to influence him, and it ended up being like a bad situation. So I think that there's both things can be true simultaneously. We see things that we're supposed to engage with or intervene in, and sometimes we do the wrong thing.
Well, sure. We can't not intervene. We can live in a cave, I suppose, but every human interaction involves some sort of intervention. Even if you just say hello, that's an intervention. Mm-hmm. So, but I know you mean it more specifically, like trying to help somebody. And it can't, I don't think it can be reduced to simple, like you have to be asked. I think that is a fairly helpful formula. Like, just check, first of all, do you want my help? Because apparently in this story, this guy didn't ask for 20,000, right? He might have asked for a quarter or something. But anyway, at no point was I suggesting like a passivity. Mm-hmm. It's just that to me, the intention, well, the road to hell, right, is built on good intentions, but I think you make it more neutral. Like the road to hell is built on intentions at all. Like having any more intentions than are needed, to me that's a problem. And obviously you can't, it's very hard to just have no intentions. You just have to have a completely blank mind. But the way that has worked for me, because as you probably both recall, I ran a thrift store in Canada for several years. Mm-hmm. in which we were constantly helping people. I kind of want to put it in quotes, but just on an ordinary physical level, we were helping them because we were giving them food, we were giving them blankets, we were giving them clothes, we were giving them time, we were giving them not anything they asked for. I didn't give them money for exactly the reason that you just said there. But that was all a response. Like we were there, people would come in, they needed help, they would ask for help, or sometimes they wouldn't ask, they'd just try and steal or what have you, and we'd say. And so to me, this is like enlightened selfishness or something. Like altruism is always, I find it's always risky, because what's your motivation? Do you want to help that person because they really, something in them that's true, first, it has to be true as well, because they might, part of them might be asking for help, but it's not a good part, but something real is asking for help and you're responding, or do you just want to help them so you can go home and stim yourself in bed that night saying how good a person you are, because we all have right. that. So my attitude in the thrift store was to be very curmudgeonly and to always be very reluctant to help people, so that I wasn't kind of forcing anything. Okay, it wasn't that I would actually stop myself, that's the point really, but I would just stand there and observe. I wouldn't just immediately go, oh, you look cold, you look hungry, right? Let's right. just see what the interaction is. And if I felt what seemed like a genuine impulse to help, which was usually the case because it was so simple, it's like this person needs a new pair of trousers, right? I mean, why am I going to say no? They're all free for us. It was really simple. But most people don't have that simplicity of running a secondhand goods store where A, you get everything for free, B, you're making lots of money, so you don't have to worry about that, and C, you're constantly meeting people who need stuff and they don't have money. It's so simple, you don't have to have a philosophy around that or an ideology. You just have to, well, I suppose, not be a greedy, money-grubbing bastard who hates people. I mean, you could be that, there are those people. But even if you've got some modicum of kindness, it's a no-brainer. So that was very helpful to me, like to get a sense of... And I can't think of any times offhand where... Well, I don't want to go on too long because I know we're getting to 2 hours, but just to finish the thought, actually, because we were a team, my wife and I, and I hinted at it with the chickens, I felt she was too generous, and I had to sort of balance it out by being, you know, the guy that they would hope he's not behind the desk today because he's going to give me a hard time, right? I had to be the kind of Judge Dredd at times, like, you've got a tab here for $50, and you're still shopping. I'm sorry, you're going to have to pay the tab before you get more stuff. Like, drawing boundaries is helpful to people too.
Sure.
So yeah, there was a whole learning curve in terms of that. You help up to a certain point and then you get a sense, and I would get it much quicker than my wife. This person's taking advantage. I don't like that, but I also know that's not good for them, because they go out and they try that with some other person and they're going to get into trouble. They won't get into trouble with me. I'll just rag on their ass and make them feel embarrassed, but they could actually get into serious, and not that I'm doing it for this reason, I'm just saying it's complementary. If I draw a boundary for me, that will always help somebody else. Right?
I do, just to touch on the Alex Jones and David Icke point, my perspective on the two of them specifically is that they're the person at the party that has to be right, that has to know the information, that has to be kind of in the forefront of, like, oh, I'm in the know, I know what's going on. And I think that that has muddied their waters, and that's maybe what's driven them a little bit insane. I saw Rogan talk to Alex Jones, and at one point in the 3-hour interview, he said, all of this knowledge that you have has driven you crazy.
Mm.
Like, it hasn't served you.
He said that. Joe Rogan said that to Alex Jones.
Yes.
And what did Alex Jones say?
he, you know, they're smoking and drinking, and he was drunk by this point in the 3-hour interview, and he just started laughing, and he was like, yeah. Like, right. He agreed that he's gone mad.
Right, so technically he's not mad because he knows he's mad.
Yeah. Well, he claims he's an actor.
Yeah, so. Well, I believe that. I believe that part. I think Joe...
In his court proceedings, he said when they asked him what his profession was, he said he's an actor.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think, you know, there, but for the grace of God goes all, perhaps it's cliche, but I think not many people could achieve that level of attention, to be get that much attention and validation and not come off the rails. And if you're Alex Jones, or anyone else, basically Russell Brand, who manages to surf the wave, then you become functionally insane, essentially. It becomes part of your stick. You become a kind of inspired, or not even that inspired, lunatic. And it doesn't matter, of course, because if you're rich and famous enough, you can be crazy, you're just considered eccentric, and you're buffered. But it's not, obviously it's not healthy for that person, and therefore it's not healthy, I would say, for anyone. I mean, I don't think that if what you're doing is harming you in some way, then I don't think it could be good for anyone else. I'm not sure. I'm sort of putting that as a question, but it seems to me if we're part of a shared field, then it's like a beehive. You don't have one of the bees going off and doing some crazy obsession that's going to benefit the whole hive, but destroy him. No, it's just not part of the way that works, I think.
I agree. Well, it has been wonderful catching up with you, Jason. It's been a long time. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us. I'm sorry it's taken quite a while to choreograph, but better late than absolutely never.
Well, we didn't actually do any dancing, so I'm not sure how much choreography was required. Yeah.
Orchestrated.
Yeah, well, likewise. I've always enjoyed our conversations, and I've enjoyed listening back to them also. Maybe let's not wait 2 years next time.
Yeah, for sure. Is there any place that these days that you want to steer somebody to find more of your work or what you're up to?
That's a good question. I mean, presumably you'll put a link, so I've got a link tree with all these different links, but to be honest, I'm not maintaining much online currently, so I don't have much to plug, except I've got another book, Big Mother, but you know, maybe we'll talk about that another day. Landmademan.com is the site. You can register there and get a newsletter, which is maybe about once a month if I'm lucky, or if you're lucky, and that gives updates on what I'm up to in the physical world, and whether or not there'll be online events, because I was doing fairly regular online events. I have recently said that I would start a men's group again if there was interest, and also a Understanding God, Children of Job group, as in let's look at this weird book of Job, let's look at the Old Testament, let's try and sort the seeds of the Bible, the good book, and find what's really of value in there, because it's a real mixed bag, as I'm sure you're aware. Anyway, those are two possibilities that may or may not happen in the future, and that's, as I've said during this interview, my main hope with doing interviews, besides having a conversation, is making contact with people I haven't made contact with before, which is, you know, by email, jason@protonmail.com. I always like it if people introduce themselves. I do one-to-ones occasionally, helping people to orientate themselves towards as much as reality as I've managed to do. Obviously, I can't take them any further than I've managed to get.
I have this great book of Job that's written by Nick Cave. I was just looking around for it to see.
That's a weird coincidence, because my sister, Freudian slip there, my sister asked me today, what did I think of Nick Cave as a Christian or as a commentator on the Bible? And I said, well, I wouldn't want to hear what he had to say, but I do think he's probably better than most. But then I kind of recalibrated. Oh yeah, maybe I would, but I had no idea he had written a book.
Yeah, well, it's a thin book that is about the Book of Job, and Chris is saying he wrote the foreword.
Yeah, what they did was they broke up the books of the Bible, and different people wrote forewords to the different books.
Yeah,
that's my understanding. Unless this is something.
Oh, I see. I thought you said that sentence, it sounded like Chris wrote the foreword to Nick Cave's book.
hold on a second, I just found it.
But now I understand. They got Nick Cave, oh, that feels a bit marketing cynical, but anyway, they got Nick Cave to write a foreword to the Book of Job. It's interesting that he picked it, though.
Yeah, exactly. He's not a Christian. At least the last interview that I heard him where that came up, he has a lot of Christian characters, and he talks about God in his songs, but he's never professed to be one himself. So,
this is a set. Jeez, of course I can't get the. This is a set
of books from
of books of the Bible, and this is the Book of Job.
The Book of Job, an introduction but it says Louis de Bernays.
He wrote the introduction, yes.
Nick Cave did what then?
Here's Revelation.
Nick Cave signed it.
He revised it. The King Nick version. King probably would be more.
Yeah, I can't remember. Somehow he's involved in this. I thought he wrote this section.
Maybe he wrote a blurb on the back or something.
Yeah. Said,
I'm Nick Cave and I write songs about the Bible. Buy them.
Maybe you have the wrong book. Maybe he wrote
I thought it was this one for some reason.
Well, somehow,
yeah, it's really...
somehow I'm relieved if it's not true. I don't know. Yeah.
It's called The Pocket Canons. The Words of the Wise.
Right.
The list on the back.
Yeah. Oh, here it is. New Testament. The Gospel according to Mark is what he wrote.
Is Nick Cave, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think so, I am relieved. I don't think I want to be.
Crisis averted.
Yeah, because I've become aware that I'm joining a kind of lineage by trying to understand the Book of Job, like finding all these other authors before me, going up thousands of years. And I think I would be disturbed if Nick Cave was in that lineage.
That's funny. We just recently had Ann Diamond on.
Oh, great.
Yeah, that I learned about her from you. So thank you for that.
Was it good? Did you have
it? It was
good,
great.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, fantastic conversation, yes. Okay, Jason, thank you so much. Have a wonderful rest of your evening. I will let you know when this comes out. And let's definitely not make it 2 years until the next time. When is Big Mother?
Halloween is supposed to be out on Halloween, so I'll have a review PDF in a couple of weeks probably.
Oh, cool! Fantastic. Well, let's definitely have you on.
Yeah,
for that.
KubraCon was just a warm up, really.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Well, as soon as you have a PDF copy, please send it to me.
Will do.
Cool.
Awesome.
All right.
It's an honor and a pleasure always to talk to you. We send you many blessings.
Thank you, Hunter. Thanks, Chris.
Yes.
Till next time.
All right. Yeah.
Alrighty.
Much love.
Bye.
Farewell.